Okay, I think it's 6:15, so let's start. I'm Richard Swanson. I teach at Augustana College, Sioux Falls. I've been there about 22 years. It seems about 22 minutes. But I have the great privilege of teaching in a place like that, where people are willing to think hard and work hard. And the chance to come here and work with you, I love this even more because Holden has a reputation, and my experience has been this is a place where people do indeed want to think very hard. So we're going to think hard for the next hour. We're going to think hard about something that in fact seems at first glance to be utterly obvious. The Messiah is crucified. No kidding. If you ask any third grader, if you gather 100 American Christian third graders and ask them what a Messiah does, they'll tell you that, of course, a Messiah dies, because they understand that to be part of the job description, for Pete's sake. That's a really interesting understanding that they have, but it is one that makes for mischief, interpretive mischief, theological mischief, and it makes it just plain difficult to read the Gospels that we have, that hand us the story of Jesus, that hand us the reality of Jesus. So what we're going to do is start really basic. We're going to start figuring out what the word Messiah means. And then we're going to figure out at some length what it would mean that he was murdered in the particular way that he was, and why I would use the word murdered rather than any other. Well, you might not agree, but I tell my students all the time, I'm handing you things that I think so that you can hand me things that you think. But if my students, I tell my students that if they come out of the class only knowing what I know and only agreeing with me, that means they're as dumb as I am. And there is no excuse for that. So we're going to talk about Messiah, and we're going to talk about murder. And then we're going to talk about the Gospel of Mark. The Gospel of Mark is... I fell in love with the Gospel of Mark 30-some years ago, studying with Donald Jewell. Some of you may have studied with him or may have heard his name. Donald Jewell, of blessed memory. We needed him, along with a lot of other people who lived to be 90 years old and crotchety, but he didn't make it. But he opened up pieces of the Gospel of Mark to me that have never let go of me. So we're going to play with the Gospel of Mark in particular. All four Gospels talk about a Messiah who's crucified. But for the sake of focus, I'm going to try hard to stay at home inside the Gospel of Mark. We'll see how I succeed. I always play with my toys wrong. I may end up wandering into Luke, who knows. But we're going to start in Mark and try to stay there. And then at the end, we're going to try to talk about why in the world you would tell this story that way. I'm going to make some suggestions, some new suggestions that I'm working on. I've worked on the Gospel of Mark, like I said, for about 30 years, and I've published a fair number of things, including something in your library, which is just really cool. Because if you've written a book, books are like children with pages, and so I've got a couple of children with pages in there. That's really cool. But in the most recent work, the work that led to the St. Mark Passion, there are some basic things that I found myself rethinking. And one of the great privileges of being a professor is you get to be wrong with your mouth open. And the great thing about publishing books is you get to be wrong permanently. And I think at least there's a couple of things that I understand differently and I hope better now. So I'll hand you some of those. Haven't published it yet, so I would appreciate good, sharp critique, because I'd love to be less wrong in print. So I'll hand you stuff that I'm thinking about. But I'm also interested in your reaction, because in all of this, we're reading a story that has a particular shape. And one of the things that I've learned about story from the time I was a little kid up till now is stories grab everybody by the gut. And that grabbing is something that teaches you something that really, really matters. I got a friend. She has the coolest job in the world, the best job title ever. Her name is Judith Rock. Some of you may know her or know of her. She is, on her own business card, she is a dance theologian. That's just the best job title ever. She was a professional dancer in New York City. who got to the age when knees and ankles started telling her that she would not be a professional dancer very much longer. Dancers get old fast. And so she studied to be a police officer and went to seminary. This woman puts together the best things in the world and makes beautiful things of them. Judith Rock, several years ago at a conference I was at, said that no one should be allowed to interpret biblical stories. In fact, no one should be allowed to interpret any story until they've been to the circus. Okay. She said she didn't mean, you know, some little flea-bitten circus with an arthritic elephant and a lion with no teeth. No, she meant a great big circus with lots of rings and lots of acts, and especially, most especially, a tightrope walker. No one should be allowed to interpret biblical texts until they've been to a circus with a tightrope walker. Why, you might ask? Well, she says that you should pay attention to the tightrope walker. You ever been to the circus? How does it go? The tightrope walker holds the pole and steps out on this impossibly thin wire. I can't imagine anyone who's not insane going out there, but he goes out. And he takes another step. And he takes another. What happens next? Have you noticed? On the fourth or fifth step, he bobbles. Have you noticed? And when he bobbles, what does everyone in the audience do? Judith Rock says, at that moment, there is revealed an essential truth about human being. Human being is linked at the gut. At that instant, you are up on the wire with the tightrope walker. Now, I had a good friend who played in a circus band for a summer, and he got to watch the tightrope walkers rehearsing. Anybody done that? Anybody seen tightrope walkers rehearse? What my friend said, I've never seen this. My friend said, well, it was the most remarkable thing. They go up, they pick up the pole, they walk out on the thing, because to them, the wire is as wide as a sidewalk. They walk out, they walk back and forth, and they say, okay, now when I get out here, I'll kneel down, and then you come out, and so they walk back and forth. The bobble is created for the audience. When we get to talking about the Gospel of Mark, pay attention to the parts of your gut that go, because there are truths there that we need to hear, all of us together, okay? Okay, Messiah. The word is difficult because it surely is a Christian word. After all, we are Christians, and Christ is the English form of Christos, which is the Greek form of the Hebrew Mashiach. Mashiach and Christos mean anointed. So since we are Christians or Messianists, we surely should know what the word means, and we should surely hold rights to it, right? Well, we borrowed that word from Jews. We actually borrowed our entire faith from the Jewish faith, but that would take longer than an hour. For right now, we borrowed the central word that makes us who we are from people that know perfectly well what it means. And just in passing, what every American Christian third grader knows is not what the word Messiah means, not what the word Christ means, not what the word Mashiach means. It is a word with a particular meaning, and the meaning matters. So, let's explore what the word means. I have a song. Linda has heard this song and sung it with me before, because as I was telling her ahead of time, I make excuses to sing this song even when it's inappropriate. If I were teaching a course in auto mechanics, we would sing this song. I sang this song to my children as a lullaby, and I sing it with every class I teach nearly, and you too. How's your Yiddish?
Oh, we're all going to sing the song.
Yes, we in fact will, or at least something here. I don't know if I have enough, so if when they go around it doesn't look like there's enough, adjust them a little bit. The song is repetitious, so that helps. Got it there in Yiddish. We'll figure out what it is, but don't worry what the words mean yet. What we're going to do is sing it. Pass them around until they get around. we're going to have nearly enough. How are we coming? Is anybody sitting where they cannot see one? Okay, we're going to sing this song. You will discover very shortly that this song is in the worst possible range for my voice. Yes, we could probably do the joke about make a joyful noise. No, it's actually uglier than that. That means if you can sing in this particular range, sing louder than I do, because it's hurtful otherwise. Christopher made me promise never to sing with a choir he's conducting. Second thing, this is a song that is physically impossible to sing while seated. You need to stand. I think it might be physically dangerous to try singing this while sitting. Okay. Oh, okay. The very first thing you hear is the melody.
We're singing this.
Is it loud enough? Too loud? Okay. Or too loud? Simple little melody.
Come to
Get in trouble when I play that song because I play it too loud. I'm probably going to have to apologize to half the village. Oh well.
The Sasquatch group was listening.
What's that?
The Sasquatch group was listening.
I bet that's Sasquatch probably sang along.
Yeah.
Sasquatch probably knows Yiddish. What can he say? Okay, we'll talk about the meaning of the words later. Don't worry about that right now. Right now, you sang a song about Mashiach, about Messiah. What did you feel? If this were your only data to define the world, the word Messiah, what would you say?
Happy.
Happy.
Joyful.
Joyful, okay. What else?
Graceful.
Graceful, praiseful. Yeah, what else?
Energy.
Energy, oh yeah, especially at the end. What else?
Makes you want to dance.
Yeah.
Makes you want to dance.
A little crazy.
A little crazy, a lot crazy. Mm-hmm. Makes you want to dance crazy, yeah. But how did it begin? Did it begin with energy and joy?
Very soft.
No, very soft. Small. It ends huge, but it starts very small. How would you describe that when you'd heard just the melody? Did you think it would end like it did? What did you think? What did you think when you heard just that?
It's the lullaby part.
It's the lullaby part. It's a part that in fact could work as a lullaby. Yes? What else? What did you think of the tune? What did it say to you? What did it touch in you?
It's a little mournful. I mean, there was a lot of energy, but yeah. It was in a minor key.
A lot. Yes.
So there was some mournfulness in it.
It is, in fact, plaintive melody that is quite mournful. Did you notice that the key doesn't change?
Mm-hmm.
And the melody, well, it doesn't change except when he's doing the klezmer stuff around it. But it's the same melody throughout. What's that?
It's rhythmic.
It is very rhythmic. But is anybody here a drummer? Any percussionists? Oh, this song makes percussionists in my college classes is crazy, because the beats are all right exactly where they should be, but they aren't where they should be in any other kind of music. Did you notice? Boom, 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 boom. That very strange placement of the beat, but the beat is exactly where it's supposed to be. It's rhythmic, but not necessarily the rhythm you'd expect it. The song that starts very small and plaintive and ends enormous. What else?
Speeds up.
Speeds up, it sure does. Boy, that thing's rolling downhill by the time you're done. And you better get out of the way. Whatever Mashiach means, it has something to do with recognizing what's plaintive and small and mournful. But by the time Mashiach is rolling, you can get out of the way or you can be in the way. Take your pick. How would you like to be roadkill? Anything else you noticed? Any clarinet players here? How did you like that sound?
Sounded like soprano sax towards
yes,
the end.
Yes,
yep.
It's different versions, they have one or both. I think this one is the soprano sax version. But what did you think of the play?
Well, my favorite part of it was the harmony at the end with the vocal harmony.
Yes, yes. How long did you work not to make noises like that on the clarinet? I had a student once describe it as illegal clarinet. Whatever Mashiach means, it would make someone who could play very, very sweetly play like that. There's a wildness to the instrumentation, a wildness to the vocal style, a wildness to the music, a wildness to the rhythm. Anything else? Yes.
I went to my first play that I think about Klezmer music.
Yes.
And I mean, just brought it all back. And,
yeah.
And yes. It was very alive.
The group is called The Klezmatics.
Right.
And the CD that is off is called, and this is one of the best CD titles ever, Rhythm and Jews.
And the group that I heard was Klezmerica.
Yes, I have them too. Not on my iPhone, but I have them at home.
I enjoyed the didgeridoo.
Yes, I'm not sure that it's a didgeridoo, but it sure does sound like one. And why you would bring a didgeridoo sound into a Messiah song is worth asking, but it fits, it belongs, it's exactly right.
Well, the didgeridoo is a sacred instrument.
You
I'm up here.
Thank you.
It comes from the sacred tradition.
Yes, so it does.
It fits.
And the sound of the didgeridoo represents what?
Well, the okay, I can't go there.
Among other things, it is the sound of the earth singing. And in some ways, it touches what Lakota people say about the drum. It is the sound of creation welling up through the instrument itself. Ooh. Whatever Mashiach is, it wells up from creation and demands and expects and celebrates all together. That piece may be the most important of all. The word Mashiach in Jewish usage is a story, it is a word that carries with it a promise to turn the world right side round. Jewish faith looks at the world and sees that things are upside down. Mashiach is one of the code words for turning the world right side up again. And one of the things that happens when the world is turned right side up is all the things that are held down and repressed and oppressed are let loose, such as, anybody read Second Baruch? Read Second Baruch. It is the coolest picture of Mashiach you'll ever see. Second Baruch is a piece that was written around the year 90 of the Common Era, around that year. It's a Jewish work that talks about coming of Mashiach. And when Mashiach comes, the soil will be set free from its bondage to futility. And so soil will be able to do what soil has always wanted to do. What does soil want to do? My dad's an ag teacher. I know this one from the time I was 5. What does soil want to do? It wants to grow things. Soil sits there and says, oh, drop something on me. I'd like to grow something. In Second Baruch, when you drop seeds on the ground, you have to walk fast because the seeds, when they hit the soil says, ooh, we can grow! And it'll grow up your pant legs. It'll grow that fast. And in fact, if you're planting a wheat field, you got to step lively because the reaper with the sickle is coming right behind you and he'll nail you in the heel if you aren't quick because the soil says, wow! It's a little like Babette's Feast. You see that movie?
Yeah.
Remember what Babette says at the end when she spent the 10,000 francs on one meal? She says, an artist just wants one time to be able to do her very best. That's what the soil says. One time. Just let me grow stuff the way I want to. Mashiach is what turns the soil loose to grow stuff the way it wants to. In fact, in Second Baruch, there's a description of grapevines. Every grapevine will have 10,000 branches. No, hold it. It's 1,000 branches. 1,000 branches. Every branch will have 1,000 clusters of grapes. Every cluster of grapes will have 1,000 grapes in it. And every grape, every single grape, will be sufficient to make 10,000 barrels of wine. Which means if you drop a grape, you drown a town. Mashiach is what sets creation loose to be what it has always longed to be. So, the song of creation welling up out of the earth, it's exactly what's going on here. The words are simple enough. Shnir leperla, string of pearls, a golden banner. Mashiach ben David sits enthroned above. Messiah, son of David, sits enthroned on high. He holds a becher. Sound like any English word you know? Beaker? Yep. He holds a goblet in his right hand. He makes a blessing, a barucha, over the entire land. The making of blessings with a goblet of wine is something that's part of Seder service. It's part of their Jewish service over and over and over again, because wine makes the heart glad. And Mashiach holds the cup of wine not to give you communion. Communion is very good, but there's not enough to make the heart really, really glad. This is a big beaker. This is a big goblet of wine intended for the entire creation to celebrate the goodness of God. Amen and amen, this is true. Messiah will come this very year. And since that's important, you repeat it. Now, the bridge is actually important. If he comes in a chariot, it'll be good years. Chariots, of course, you know, were the most powerful military instrument of the time in the ancient world. If you had chariots, you had maneuverability and your army. You had to be a really bad army to lose if you had a good chariot corps. If he comes in a chariot with all military power, it'll be good. It'll be good years. If he comes riding, if he comes on a horse, that's still a big deal. It's not as good as a chariot, but it's still a big deal. It'll be good times. Gute Zeiten. But the last line, anybody here read German? Can you make sense of it? Oi, Wetter kommen zu gehen. Even if he has to walk, the Jews will live in the land of Israel. The song says, if Messiah has chariots at his disposal, he'll come in chariots. If Messiah has a horse at his disposal, he'll ride a horse. But even if Messiah has to walk, Messiah's coming. When? This very year. Those feelings, those ideas, those images are what Messiah means. Messiah takes the plaintive hopes of people that have waited too long and says, what you hoped for, what your grandmother hoped for, what her grandmother hoped and prayed for, is now coming to fruition. I don't know your lives. You don't know mine. But you know the lives of your family. And odds are good that your family story is something like my family story. When my mother's father came of age, he was the eldest son living in Västergötland in Sweden, near Göteborg. And as the eldest son, it was his responsibility to leave home and earn money for the family, because the family was starving. And so my mother's father was delegated to go to the United States. And when he left, he promised his mother and his father that he would do his duty to the family. He never returned. He made enough money. He was a carpenter, a good one. He could have returned, but he never returned. He never saw his mother again, never saw his father, never saw his sister or his brothers. I asked him once why he didn't go back. He said, leaving Sweden was like dying, and you only die once. Schneerele, perele, gildene von Mashiach ben David sitzt heuten an. I think of the song, and I think that when the world is turned right side round, eldest sons won't have to cross the ocean and never see their mother again. When the world is turned right side round, there won't be starving children. When the world is turned right side round, everything will work the way it should. Mashiach is a Jewish hope that says things should not work the way they work now.
Would you repeat that?
Ooh, which part? Mashiach is the Jewish hope that says things are not the way they should be now. When God created the world, God created enough for human flourishing. Are all human beings flourishing? Jewish faith looks at that fact and says something's upside down. Why are not all human beings flourishing? If God created enough for everyone to flourish, if we are not all of us flourishing, and there are children who have starved to death in the little while I've been talking with you now, it means that somebody's gathering too much for themselves. Which makes it kind of interesting when you look at what the image of Mashiach is. Mashiach is the one who right side ups the world. If some people, and it would be us, have filled our pockets with so many things, because if you put it in your pocket, you get to keep it. And you got to keep it because you might not have enough tomorrow, and you got to keep a little more because you might need a little more than that. And you've heard the slogan, whoever dies with the most toys wins. Yeah, we filled our pockets with as many toys as we can possibly fill them. We've got our pockets as full of everything as we can possibly have them full. What happens when you turn the world right side up?
They all drop out.
All the stuff falls out of the pockets and it rains down on the ground, and all the people from whom we have stolen will have enough. Great old rabbinic story. If you haven't read the rabbis, read the rabbis, because the rabbis taught me how to read Christian scripture. Rabbis say, there was a man once who wanted a vision of heaven. No, a vision of hell. Let me do it in the right order. There was a man once wanted a vision of hell. Why would you want a vision of hell? He wanted a vision of hell. An angel was dispatched to him and said, you really want a vision of hell? What are you, some kind of a nut? And he said, I want a vision of hell. And so he said, okay. Took him into a room. And in the room there was a long table. And on the table there was a linen tablecloth. And on the linen tablecloth there was crystal and china and gold candelabra. There was every kind of food. It was like your grandma's best Thanksgiving dinner ever. Everything smelled wonderful. It was just beautiful. All the people who were ushered in. The guy said, I thought you were taking me to hell. The angel said, shh. All the people were ushered in. And the guy said, I get it. They're all going to have to stand behind the chairs and see that the food is not for them. The angel said, would you be quiet? The people who were ushered in, they sat down. There was a name tag for each one of them. They sat at their own place with the best food they'd ever seen on the table in front of them. They went to eat and they discovered that they did not have elbows. They tried to eat the food. They couldn't get it to their face. They did everything they could think of. They tried putting their faces in the plates, but when they did that, other people stole their food, so they quit putting their faces in the plates. Chaos broke out. The guy said, I see why it's hell. Show me a vision of heaven. The angel said, kind of pushy, aren't you? Took him to a room, long table with a linen tablecloth, crystal, china, gold candelabra, best food ever. The guy said, I think we were just here. The angel said, would you be quiet? People were ushered in. Ah, the man said. They all sat down. I get it. In hell you don't have elbows, and in heaven you do. The angel said, would you just shut up once and listen? Watch, pay attention. Everyone sat down. No one had elbows. No one noticed that they needed them. Everyone reached across the table and fed the person opposite them. Because when they looked across, they said, there's someone who's hungry. And of course, the person on the other side said, ooh, someone else is hungry. Everyone fed everyone. Mashiach ben David ushers in a world where you don't need elbows. That's what Mashiach means. So, Messiah is crucified. Messiah is murdered. Let's just go as far as Messiah dies. By the way, do we live in a world where you don't need elbows? So much. Do we live in a world where children never starve? Not so much. Do we live in a world that's clearly right side up? So Messiah didn't finish Messiah's job. Oh, but that'll all happen in heaven. Notice what a wonderful dodge that is. All of a sudden, the whole song, Shneur LaParala, doesn't have to apply to anything. But it allows you to say someone whose child has just starved, oh, but in heaven you'll sing a song and you'll really like it. It's a cool song. It's in Yiddish. What does it mean for Messiah to die? If Messiah means the world to be turned right side up, what does it mean for Messiah to die?
Cut short the mission.
Cut short the mission. The mission is stopped. This is a strange and frightful truth. But just one step on the way. The Jews who thought Jesus was worthy and properly called Mashiach ben David told stories in which that Messiah dies and the world stays upside down with the mission unfinished. Yes, 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 you've heard, I've heard, we've all heard the sermons, we've preached them, some of us, the already but not yet sermon. That's a really good sermon, that works great. Does that satisfy you if it's your child who's starving? No, not so much. About 4 years ago, my sister, having lived for 2 years with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, died. I was raised with a really robust notion of what the hereafter will be. I expect she and I will continue our arguing right where we left off. I cannot wait. Does that satisfy me or you? Not so much. Not so much. For Messiah to die means that we are stuck with a world that is still upside down. What does it mean for Messiah to be murdered? What's that ad? What do you think? Right here, the Judith Rock moment. Messiah dies. That's sad. That's unfortunate. Messiah is murdered.
It's violence.
It's violent. And it's violence directed at? What would you say? Where do you feel it?
It's the Messiah, but it's the whole vision of what Messiah is.
Yes. Now Messiah, the vision, is attacked. Mm-hmm. Not just, not yet fulfilled, but attacked. And attacked successfully. It's a strange way to tell a Messiah story. One more layer. Messiah is not just murdered. Messiah is crucified. Now we're back to where American third graders all know the answers, because crucifixion is something that only happens to Jesus, and it's so that your sins will be forgiven, and that's all really good, so we're all happy now. The problem is that any conceivable audience for the text that's the Gospel of Mark would have looked at that and would have been appalled, because crucifixion is something they knew. Ever seen anyone crucified? Other than in Passion Plays. Everyone who heard the Gospel of Mark told had seen people crucified. Crucifixion was an obscenity, so vile that people like us were taught not to say the word cross. There are manuals out of the ancient world that describe how to grow up to be a real human being. And, you know, don't pick your teeth, don't burp at the table, never put your feet on the coffee table. All those things are in there. But also with them is, don't say the word cross. Because it is an obscenity so vile that it ought not ever touch your tongue. Are there words that you simply won't say? Sure there are. Words that taste so bitter that you simply will not use those words? Cross in the ancient world is worse than the worst of those. My family and I go to Holy Cross Lutheran Church. Imagine how that would have sounded in the ancient world. Holy, fill in the blank. The manuals go on to say, don't ever stop to watch a crucifixion. And probably for good reason. My father-in-law used to travel and sell tires, batteries, and accessories for Conoco. Traveled in a 5-state area, sold people stuff that they needed, and didn't sell them stuff they didn't need. He was good at that. But one of the things that comes when you travel a lot is you see a lot of car crashes. My father-in-law had a Navy blanket in his back, in his trunk, that he kept there to put over the corpses on the road. If you know anyone who travels, ask them about car crashes, but ask them especially about the people that slow down to look. My father-in-law hates those people, and he doesn't hate very much. He hates those people because they've all convinced themselves that they're slowing down to see if there's anyone needs help. He says there's not a one of them is hoping that anyone needs help. They're slowing down so that they can see a corpse. He saw one crash where the head was severed and bounced down the highway. And he saw a family with kids pointing and laughing at the splotches of blood down the highway. Yeah. My father-in-law says they're all a bunch of animals. The ancient manuals know that. If you stop and watch crucifixions. It will sing to something in you, deep down, that wants to see blood. You want to be a human being? Don't. Don't say the word. Don't even think the word. What's it do to the notion of Mashiach? That obscenity is what stops Mashiach. It actually gets worse than that. Because it's an obscenity that was not just an accidental obscenity, it was a purposeful obscenity. Crucifixion is something that the Roman Empire used to demonstrate that it had no moral compunction at all. People were tortured to death in public for sport. And for political object lessons. Rome, at home, was a wonderful, forward-looking republic, among other things. But Rome in the conquered provinces was a very different thing, because Rome maintained control at any cost. If I'm maintaining control over your nation, one of the things you need to know about me is, if you get out of line, I will punish you. Slap your wrist really hard. No. If you get out of line, I'm going to start killing people. I'm going to crucify one Jew after another Jew after another Jew, just until you catch on that this is a problem. I'll crucify you too if you're the troublemaker. I'll leave you hanging up naked in public along the road, dying over 6 days, just to point out that there's nothing that I won't do. About 30 years ago, 35 now, I worked with a guy in a butcher shop who liked to get into bar fights. He's the only one I ever knew that liked to get into bar fights, but I worked with a guy who liked to get into bar fights. He'd spent, he said, about 3 years on the bum, that was his phrase, and during that time he'd been in a lot of bar fights. He had knife slices in his face. And he used to talk about what fun bar fights were. I had worked with some odd people in my time. I asked him one day, just because I couldn't resist, if he'd ever been afraid in a bar fight. And he said, oh no, bar fights are fun. You don't get afraid. Well, though, you get afraid once in a while. Because if you look across the way and you see that the person opposite you is afraid, you should run. Because a person who's afraid is liable to do anything. The rest of us are just having fun, knocking each other around, breaking a nose or two. But if you look across the way and you see that the person across from you is afraid, run, because he'll do anything. That's what Rome wanted to be clear. By the way, I'll do anything. I won't mind. In fact, I'll enjoy it. What's that mean for Mashiach ben David? That it's not just dying, it's not just murder, it's not just crucifixion. It's Rome demonstrating that it can do anything it wants. What's that say? What's that feel? What do you notice? Talk to anybody's gut? For Jews in the first century, the Common Era, Rome was the force that held the world upside down. When the Gospel of Mark tells the story of Messiah, who comes to turn the world right side up. And the Gospel of Mark tells the story of Rome crucifying that Messiah and taunting the faith. Why did Pilate put the sign above his head, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews? Because he wanted to make it clear to everyone that he wasn't just killing, murdering, crucifying one guy who was a troublemaker. He was intending to crucify Jewish hope at its very heart. And demonstrate that it's really cute that you have a hope that God will turn the world right side up. It's charming. Isn't it sweet how she has a hope that God will turn the world right side up? I find that quaint and lovely. And then Rome says, however, I crucify quaint and lovely before noon every Thursday. I suppose you could answer that the Jews who believed Jesus was properly called Messiah told stories of a murdered, of a crucified Messiah because that's what happened historically. Surely the case. But stop for a second and think. They didn't tell stories of Jesus crucified as a martyr. In fact, the Gospels very carefully disqualify Jesus as a martyr. Go read a bunch of martyr stories and find me one where the martyr at the decisive instant says, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" What do martyrs say when they die? "I regret that I have but one life."
Take it from my countrymen.
That's what a martyr says. Ancient world, modern world, that's what a martyr says. Jesus is not painted as a martyr, though he could have been. Other martyr stories are told. Read 4th Maccabees, loaded with martyr stories. They could have told Jesus was a teacher story, because he was appropriately called a teacher, or Jesus the healer. He was all of those things. Jesus the prophet. All of those things would fit with everything we know about the character and wouldn't cause any trouble. The dying of a prophet or a teacher or of a martyr is part of what you expect. Why did they decide to tell the story only, insistently? The only title, this is Nils Dahl from about 40 years ago, the only title that the early Christian movement insists on for Jesus is Messiah, and it is the only one that he is singularly unqualified for. They somehow decided to tell the story in the way that would cause the greatest tension and provoke the most powerful thought. So why? Let's look at a little bit of Gospel of Mark and see if we can pull a couple of answers out. First one, this is from Mark 14, and if you have Bibles along, you can read with me if you like, Mark 14, 3 and following. While he was at Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, he sat at a table. A woman came with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment of nard, and she broke open the jar and poured the ointment on his head. But some were there who said to one another in anger, "Why was the ointment wasted in this way? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii, a year's wages, and the money given to the poor." And they scolded her. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has performed a good service for me. For you always have the poor with you, and you can show kindness to them whenever you wish, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. Truly I tell you, wherever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her." What do you hear? What do you notice? Anything snag your ear when that ran by? I read it fast to make it a little hard, but I was just wondering if anything snagged you.
Well, if anointing, if Messiah means anointed,
It means the Gospel of Mark is indeed the story of an anointed one. Who anoints him?
A woman.
Unnamed. Good old, what's her name?
It's not.
I was, for the very first time, using storytelling as a mode of engagement in a class, and said to the class, they were required to learn 2 chapters of the Gospel of Mark for the final project and perform it, and then write a 20-page essay supporting and exploring their performance. But I said to the class, but of course, if you wanted to learn the entire Gospel, you wouldn't have to write the 20-page essay, just perform the entire Gospel, but I don't think you can do it. After class, 2 people bustled up and grabbed me and said, "Did you really mean that?" I decided that I must have meant it, so I said, "Sure." They learned the Gospel and performed it. Michael just didn't want to write a 20-page paper. Erica didn't like the fact that I'd said I didn't think she could do it. So I was sitting in my office doing professorial things, working very hard, taking a nap. No, that's not what I was doing, but I was there. And the door was closed, and the door slammed open and knocked books off the shelf, everything. In comes Erica, spitting and spluttering, talking so fast and so so angrily that she couldn't even say words. I mean, she was not even up to syllables yet. She was just making sounds. Michael came along a little bit afterward, looking a little bewildered. When she finally got to words, she said, "How in the world, how dare they? How can they possibly tell the story like that and claim that there'll be a memorial for her and there's no name on the memorial? How can we possibly..." It was a lovely moment. It opened up all sorts of discussions about Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza and the Gospel of Mark and the role of women in the Gospel of Mark, which, by the way, is essential. As you get to the end of the Gospel of Mark, you'll see in the St. Mark Passion, when all the men are off hiding under their beds, who is it that comes to tend to Jesus and watches even when he's obscenely crucified? It's the women. How many women? Very many women. How long have they been there? Ever since the beginning in Galilee. They followed and they deaconed to him. The word is diakoneo. It means, it's a word that's translated as they had served him. Elizabeth Moltmann Wendel did a nifty little study. It's a word that when it has a woman as its subject, it's translated into English, German, and French as wait tables, serve, or cook. When it is translated with a male subject, every time it's translated as serve as deacon in church. Yeah. Translators are really stupid sometimes. Yeah, me too. But translators are really stupid. And that reveals something that's so easy. That's low-hanging fruit. You can pick that one real simple without even stretching. The translators obviously assume women couldn't be deacons in church. What matters for us is that the deacon was the person who was responsible in the ancient Christian community to connect need with resource. And so a deacon had to know who was out of work and who was hired, who got put out of their house, and who had a spare room. The women are the ones who went with Jesus everywhere and found people who needed what Mashiach ben David could offer. How did people know to approach Jesus? I guess we just found out. The very many women connected them. Did you see them doing it? Huh. It's pretty easy to forget a woman's name, isn't it? Nifty little story, old what's-her-name, but she is the first of very many women, most of whom have no names in our stories, and you don't know them. Storyteller wanted you to think about that. What else do you notice? She anoints Jesus. And I have to keep looking because I preach at Vespers tonight, and so I better not go long. I guess they can't start without me, can they?
For his burial.
What's that?
He's anointed for his burial.
He's anointed for his burial. Why would you tell a story like that? Yes, 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 of course he was buried. Yes, 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 we're used to predictions of the Passion. But notice, he's made Mashiach, and for one moment he's anointed in the story. He's actually Mashiach, anointed by a woman who, if you look at the broader rhetoric of the story, means you can trust this. The men mostly have the brains of ice cubes. I tell my students that the male disciples are called Peter, James, and John, Curly, Larry, and Moe, because they're painted as absolute dolts. But women know what's what. In fact, read the Syrophoenician woman story. A woman even schools Jesus. He says to her, when she asks him to heal her daughter, "I don't do favors for dogs like you." Does she come home with her daughter healed? Yep. Any women in the room have learned how to get things done like that?
Don't tell on us.
Oh, I have time. I'll tell it really fast. My sister was hired out of college to be a data analyst at the Department of Traffic Safety in the state of Minnesota. She was the first woman hired ever in that department. She was a token woman. They'd been told they had to hire a woman, and so they hired her, but they were pretty sure that she couldn't do the job because she was a woman, and she was going to have to work with statistics, for Pete's sake, and everybody knows women can't, whatever. My sister was Phi Beta Kappa, summa cum laude, out of St. Olaf College, for Pete's sake, and they thought she couldn't count stiffs. She came, she took the job, she did the job. At her first annual review, her boss, who, if you look up Clueless on Wikipedia, there's his face. Her boss sat her down and said, "Kathy, I just want to tell you how good it's been having you here. You've done such a good job. We've been so pleased. It's just been a delight to work with you. In fact, it's been so good, it's been almost like having a man in the position." He said those words. He said, that's a quote. So what do? My sister said, hitting him occurred to her. She looked him in the eye and said, "Thank you." And stayed in the Department of Traffic Safety for 23 years and took his job. Women of a certain age had to learn how to navigate those waters. This woman schools Jesus because he had not yet learned. Well, the gender matters, but this woman, who is of incredible importance, anoints him only for burial. So we're going to take the hope that kept our grandmothers alive, that the world will finally be turned right side up and they will see their children rather than just sending them off across the ocean. The story takes that hope and anoints it for entombment. Why? There's more passages we should look at. Read Mark 14, read Mark 15. Look slowly at how Pilate taunts the hopes of Jews and realize that the messianist who told this story could have told it differently. You can tell stories 100 different ways. Why did they tell it that way? A suggestion, which I can do in 3 minutes, he said, hopefully.
That's kind of what you're...
The Gospel of Mark is told in this form for the very first time sometime around before the year 100, but after the year 70. Why does that matter? In the year 70, the first Jewish revolt against Rome was crushed. The revolt, according to historians who do this sort of thing, military historians, I'm not one, the revolt should have succeeded, could have succeeded. Rome was distracted. They could have sued for peace, but they had a civil war instead. I mean, why not hold a civil war? We haven't had one in a week or two. Let's have another civil war. Rome came back and besieged the city of Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem had enough grain stored up that they could have withheld, according to historians, could have held out for a siege of 5 years. Most historians say Rome would never have lasted 5 years. They would have made peace, and Jews could have had a relatively calm life under Roman distant overlordship. The Zealots, remember them? Thought people weren't fighting vigorously enough. How do you get people to fight vigorously? Well, you burn the food supply, of course. Of course! Rome breached the city wall. Rome destroyed the temple, which, by the way, is a big deal because the temple is understood. Jewish faith understands the world to be a dangerous place, full of watery chaos everywhere. But fortunately, in the middle of real danger, there is the land of promise, which is a quasi-safe place. And in the symbolic center of the land of promise is the city of Jerusalem, which is a safer place than the land of promise. It's a safe place. It's a more Jewish place. In the symbolic center of the city of Jerusalem is the temple. More Jewish, more safe, more stable. And in the very symbolic center of the most safe place on earth is the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies is the place where God's finger was understood to touch the earth and hold it still. So that no matter how crazy things were outside, this was one safe, quiet place where creation could flourish and Jews could live peaceably. What happens when you destroy the temple in a system that understands God's finger to hold the world still? You knock God's finger off the world. Notice what I just said. When the Romans destroyed the temple, they knocked God's finger off the world. Why might you tell a murdered Messiah story after that? Well, the two things are clearly knit together. There is a powerful reflection going on here about how it is that you can hope for anything in a world where Rome is this strong. Some of that reflection is tragic. Some of that reflection is realistic. It's really charming watching children grow up and believe that their daddy is smarter and stronger than anybody. Then they learn that you're just a chump like everyone else. Children believe that their mom can fix anything. Did you ever have to help your child understand that that wasn't true? It'll do something to you. The first time you have to look at your child and say, I really can't. I would give anything to, but I really can't. This is a realistic reflection like that. But it is a theological reflection that does at least two things. One thing, it critiques zealotry in every form. If you think you can turn the world right side up by yourself, by military force or any other force, don't. Because this force, this narrative says, you see how that turns out? God's finger gets knocked off the world. God's Messiah gets crucified. Don't participate. But second, it says, we may not know how God will turn the world right side up. Doesn't mean we don't hope. Doesn't mean we don't wait. Doesn't mean we don't yearn. I'm the son of an ag teacher, so if anybody starves in the world, it's an offense to my father and to me. But since we can't turn the world right side up, and since God seems not to have done it yet, a murdered Messiah story says to you, what parts can you turn right side up? Perhaps God will get around to it, perhaps not. But until God does get around to it, what can you turn right side up? What can you turn? It's a story that provokes little acts of creational kindness. And on that note, boy, do I have to run. But please, let's talk. This is something that I'm trying to figure out with all my might. And that last little bit about how this flows and the possibility that this is all finally a tragic story meant to help people lament for what was lost in the temple. Messiah stories as a powerful form of lament for the temple is the piece that I'm trying to work on. So let's drink coffee and talk. Thank you.